So for those of you who have come from the outside, we were actually in retreat here. We have been involved, about 45 of us, 20 here in residence, and about 25 online, have been involved in a five-day retreat since Wednesday that goes through to tomorrow. Most of the people in the front rows or other people scattered around have been on retreat with us. So retreat is a very, it goes back to the time of the Buddha, but a very important part of our practice, especially these days. As we know, without saying it, we all know it, life is busy, a lot of activity with electronics, a lot of stimulation. So even though we are making an attempt to quiet our mind, to learn various kinds of teachings, reading, listening to talks, it is very difficult to integrate them into our life, right? Because we're sort of learning on the hoof, you know what I mean? It's we're fitting in among lots of other things. So to be able to take the time to step back from our responsibilities, our daily activities, our personal devices, and be on retreat so we can focus very single-mindedly in the support of a larger community of practitioners is very essential. So we've been on retreat. The retreat is called Simplicity and Ease. And we've gone for 5 days. So, and this is called a wisdom retreat. So for those of you, anybody not familiar with our community, within our community, the Florida Community of Mindfulness, we sort of have three paths. It's sort of a developmental three paths of practice. First path of practice we call mindful living. And this is where, many people learn, sort of the basics of how to lead a mindful life, how to calm their mind, how to be present in life with presence, right, to everything that goes on. It's really how to kind of live life in a much calmer, open way, all right? As well as at the Mindful Living Path, we focus on emotional healing. Many people come and they really want to follow a spiritual path, but they still have, lots of stuff going on, that's always disturbing their mind. So at this level, we work on emotional healing. So that's the mindful living path. And then, some people, that's what they come for. Other people, the Dharma path. So when we get into Dharma, we're getting now into the teachings of the Buddhist tradition. Sort of, the Buddha taught a way of living. And part of the way of living is how do we understand life? How do we understand what's going on in human life? So we can deal with life, in a wholesome way and not, always be in conflict or always being, our minds always being disturbed by afflictive emotions, etc. So the Dharma is where we learn, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Marks of Existence. Anybody's ever taken a comparative religion course, these are the things. We learn about loving kindness and compassion. We learn about developing patience. And we're really learning how to kind of retrain the way we perceive life so we can really become sort of wiser, more open, more loving human beings. So that's the Dharma path. Okay, it's the next step. But this retreat is what we call a wisdom retreat. And this is really gets into sort of the Buddhist path much more deeply. Because even though the Buddha taught for 49 years. So he was a very public teacher and he was teaching daily and had a large community around him, as well as he was always moving around northern India teaching all kinds of people. So there's a vast body of teachings that he has left to, and has been taught, you know, in practice for thousands of years now, to help guide us in how to lead a noble life. But we have to remember that the Buddha is only, or was only called the Buddha because of his enlightenment. This is very important. Before his great enlightenment, he was just Siddhartha. He was just another one of the many types of hermits and recluses and spiritual seekers, kind of wandering around northern India, taking teachings, practicing meditation. But it was only when he had this great enlightenment that he was, called, the enlightened one, the Buddha. Buddha means enlightened one. That's not his family name. Actually, he's called Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakya is his clan name. So we have to really understand, while the voluminous teachings and practices with Buddhism, really what the essence of what the Buddha taught was not only the enlightenment experience, but also the path that it can be replicated by all of us, right? So there are these two aspects. One is the Buddha's own personal awakening, and then his understanding that what he had discovered was latent in everyone's mind, and that what he had experienced can be experienced by everyone. So this is fairly radical. Okay. And I'll explain why. So up until his great enlightenment, the Buddha was like the rest of us. He had a name. He had a mind and body, and he had a narrative with going on within his mind of who he was and who he wasn't, right? And he was totally identified with his own individuality, his own self. And his purview did not go outside his thoughts and concepts and beliefs about himself and everyone else. And basically, his perception of life was, I am here and everything else is out there, which is the way most of us see it, right? That's called the world of separation, the world of duality. I'm here, you're over there. The trees are out there. The sky is up there. See, it's like I'm a separate thing, separate from everything else, right? Are you following me? Anyhow, he's having what we would call a normal human experience, right? And then when he was in deep meditative states, he would have a different experience, a vast oceanic kind of oneness and things. But then when he would come out of these meditative states, he would still be back in this dualistic state, this sense, I'm here, you're there, right? We call this the world of birth and death, right? That's what a human being is, born here, lives, dies, right? And everything participates in that. So what happened in his great enlightenment, and again, Buddhism really begins with his great enlightenment, he had what we could say an experience. Because, and what is he doing? He's meditating deeply on what? On his own mind. Right? Not a Buddha mind, his own mind. What was his mind? His mind was just like ours, right? A mind of what? thoughts, feelings, perceptions, the mind that sees and smells and tastes and touch and right, and remembers and has a sense of like all of this is happening, you know, I am seeing, I am hearing, I am smelling, I am tasting, I am touching, I am thinking, I am remembering, I am meditating. You see, there's always this sense of me. This we call this a constructed self that we believe is true. But in his meditation, by looking, by using the powers of concentration and insight to look deeply into his own mind, he was able to break through this, we call this a conditioned mind, right? In Buddhism, it sort of has 8 levels. It has seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, conceiving, sense of self, and like a storehouse consciousness that holds the remnants of everything we've ever thought or felt. You know, it's like where stuff comes from. You know your stuff, you know your stuff, and you go to sleep and you wake up the next day and there it is again. And you go, how does that happen, right? You know, because during sleep, you were unconscious. You might think, I wake up in the morning, none of that from yesterday or last year would be here, but there it is. So we have a storehouse consciousness. Most of us, this is the world we live in, right? And we would say, yes, this is my mind. It's all going on in my mind, right? It's all, you know, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, sights, sounds, remembering, all my issues, all my problems, all my loves, all my hates, all my, you know, it's all the mind. So in his meditation, he had an extraordinary experience where he broke out of or broke through that conditioned little self-mind. And all of a sudden he experienced in his own mind something very different. All of a sudden, there was this vast, open, aware space of mind, I might say capital M. And that was totally unconditioned. Right? Meaning it had no characteristics or definition at all. It had no beginning or end. It had no top or bottom. There was no birth and death in any of this. It was vast, spacious, open, totally aware, and alive. Right. And there was a quality of it that it knew that this was my true mind. There was a knowing, right? So his enlightenment was, he became enlightened to what? To his true mind. We call that a Buddha mind. So he didn't go, wow, this is pretty good, right? I have a Buddha mind. It wasn't like that. He realized that every being, this is the intrinsic nature of their mind, right? Just stop a second and ask yourself, what is the intrinsic nature of my mind? You know, like, just ask yourself this, you know, I mean, this is not a profound question. If you were going to go, yeah, what's the characteristics of my mind? You know, we're just honest, you know, this mind that we live in, that we wake up with in the morning, that's with us all day, that's there at the end of the day. It's the first one we talk to in the morning. It's the last voice we hear at night, you know, even has these crazy dreams during the night, right? Our minds. So what words come to you if you're going to describe, you know, kind of the nature of your mind? So people online, how many people are online today, Scott? 86 people online. We have about 30, 40 people in the hall. We have nice. So what words come to you when you're just describing your ordinary, you know, mind? What? Affected? Defective. Okay. Anything else? Anybody else? Busy. Unreliable. Overly analytical, very analytical. A lot of thinking. Aware. Yeah, just chat in, people. Scott will tell us. You know, when you look into your mind, what is the nature of your mind? You know, what's it like? How does it appear to you? Busy. Well, everybody has a mind here. Clear. What?
Clear.
Thoughts.
What?
Thoughts, worries.
Thoughts, worries.
Chaos.
A work in progress. What, is there a sign in there saying work in progress? Curious. So, all right. So we see a mind, endless qualities, right? Some people saw good qualities. Some people saw not so good qualities, okay? That's not what the Buddha saw. He saw a mind that was beyond any definition. And it was uncontaminated, it was naturally pure, which means all Siddhartha's conditioning, all his thoughts, all his, you know, desires and hurts and happinesses and sadness and frustrations and yearnings and all his stories, right, that we carry in our minds, right? You know what I'm talking about? None of that was there. Totally pure, uncontaminated at all. Beyond birth and death. And, you know, so in modern terms, we might say he was blown away by that experience. And it is said that for 7 weeks, he just reveled in this incredible freedom and bliss of liberation. You know, it's like all, you know, it's all of a sudden like, what's it gonna be like? You know, it's like, you know, you've been in prison or something, or you're in solitary confinement for 30 years, right? You know what I'm saying? And all of a sudden, you're out one day, right? And you go, you know, you look up at the sky, maybe you haven't seen the sky. Maybe you haven't heard a bird, you know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? And you go, wow, freedom, right? So that's what it was like. It was an experience of incredible freedom, because the whole burden of self and the constrictions of self and separation, because all of a sudden he was not separate from anything. He realized that his mind embraced, his true mind embraced everything, and everything was just arising in mind. So anyway, I could go on and on, but that's in a wisdom retreat, that's what we're doing, okay? So at a wisdom retreat, we are, and again, it's for those people who want to really understand deeply the nature of their own mind. Why? Because they want to end suffering. They want to be free, you see? And where does our suffering come from? Because we identify with this small self. and all its needs and all its wants and its desires and its hurts and its angers and its greed and all its identifications and all its ideas and all its opinions, right? You know, that's what's going on all the time. And so we wonder why, you know, why do I, you know, why don't I feel peaceful? You know, why isn't my heart open? Right? You know, I'd like to be that way, but our mind isn't like that. So many of us do what? We work hard, don't we? We work hard at change, at transforming. Becoming a kinder person, a more compassionate person, quieting our mind, stabilizing our mind, healing our emotional wounds, right? Right? That's what we do. But that's all done within the framework of the narrative of self, right? We're trying to make a nicer, kinder self, more peaceful self. Let me just say, that's wonderful. I wish everybody in the world did that, right? It'd be a much different world. But what the Buddha discovered in his enlightenment was there was the deepest aspect of what it means to be a human being in terms of their mind is this true nature. This boundless, undefiled awareness that is always present, and it's clear, and it's the source really of all wisdom. And his discovery was, it's already here, right? So many people think, I'm here, why am I screwed up? Right? Boy, am I neurotic. And I got to go over there, work really hard to get clear. Right? So usually our spiritual journey, our healing journey, is to get from where I am to somewhere, some perfected state. Is that clear? I mean, isn't that the way most of us do? You know, the Buddha says, no, it's already here. You know? It's like the gold is already here. It's right here. But it's covered over. Why is it covered over? Because we're lost in what? What are we lost in all day? Thoughts, stories, the drama in life, right? That's all that concerns us. That's the whole, that consumes us. You know, these days some people have trouble sleeping, right? They wake up in the night. What's going on? Thoughts, stories, right? We're just consumed, right? By this internal processing we do about the world. And the Buddha says, no. In within your mind, there is this another aspect. It's clear. It's always calm. It's always still. It's already, since it's already here. So you can see the process then becomes what at this point? Letting go. Relaxing and looking deeply. So that's sort of what we do on a wisdom retreat. It's a meditative retreat. We spend a lot of the day, we get teachings, instructions, and then we spend a lot of time meditating. So even though Buddhism, you know, from the time of the Buddha to over 2,600 years ago, has manifested in many different cultures, countries, now it's coming more to the West in our country, and, you know, practiced in many, many different ways, this experience of enlightenment, of awakening, of being free is really at the center of it. And we are fortunate that even to today, this transmission of this awakened mind from one generation to the next, which means awakened people passing it on. I mean, it's not like something you pass on. It means passing on the teachings and the practices that help people wake up again and again, generation after generation, is still alive in this world, right? So if you see, you know, people like in Buddhism, the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, and you wonder, wow, they're special beings, right? How'd he get like that? You practice the mindful living path, the Dharma path, but most importantly, they know the nature of their mind. This is what fuels their capacity to be so energetic and fearless in their willingness to help humanity in any way they can, because they know the nature of their true mind. And they really know why people suffer. They suffer because they don't know who and what they really are. As it is said, it's like a beggar who has in their hovel, you know, this rock, this dirty rock that they think is just a rock, and they spend their day in poverty begging, right? They don't know that rock is just encrusted with dirt, and it's a gold bar, you see? We don't know that our true mind is right here. And why don't we know it? Because we're too busy, lost in the world of self, lost in the narrative self, lost in the activities of self. Who's got time for this, right? So fortunately, there are some people. So that's what a retreat is, and that's what we've been up to. But again, we have a developmental path here. So we understand for people, you know, just starting out, like in any path, you know, like going to school, you don't begin, you know, at the PhD level, do you? No, we send children to elementary school, where they learn the basics. And then over the years, they develop. And some want to go on for higher learning, higher experience. So in the same way, and you know, elementary school is very essential for 6, 7, 8 year olds and 9 year olds. And you know what I mean? So it's not as if all the learning that we do at the various levels is not essential and important. But it's also important that we know that this path can really resolve all our issues, if that's what we want, right? So I just want to spend a few minutes not reading from Flight of the Garuda, because we're already sort of right in the midst of this teaching, and it's very profound, and it'd be very hard for people who haven't been on retreat to understand it. But there is something that we chant. Those who have been here and been to our chanting service, it's called Verses on Trust and Mind. It's by the third Zen patriarch, and I'll just share a few lines that kind of give you a taste of what I'm talking about. So it's interesting. This is considered the third patriarch of We're more familiar with the name of Zen, which is a Japanese word. Actually, Zen comes from China. In China, it was called Chan. And there were six kind of early patriarchs of Chan. And this Verses on Trust in Mind was by the third Chan patriarch. Hardly anything is known about him. Some people not even sure, you know, that he even wrote this, even though it's been attributed to him. So it's a much loved text. But just to give you a little flavor of Chan Zen, so this is his enlightenment experience. Okay, so his name is Tseng Zan, and he comes to the second Zen patriarch, whose name is Wiko. And he says to him, "Master, my body is riddled with sickness. Please, Master, absolve me of my sin, my sins." Now, what does that mean? So he's in a culture. Sins is more of a Western or you know, that's not really what it's called in Buddhism traditionally. So they just translate it. But there is a belief, right? You know, in karma, people have heard karma, cause and effect. So he believes that the reason his body is so sick is because he's reaping the karma, right, of past deeds, right? So we would call sinful deeds. He's acted in bad ways. And now his sins are causing him to have this diseased body. So he goes to the master and he says, "I'm riddled with sickness, which I believe is caused by my past sins. Please absolve me of my sins." Right? "Father, I have sinned." Right? And in other traditions, they would go through some ritual to absolve him of his sins, right? Listen to what Wiko does. So you have to kind of be in the mind state. So you're Wiko, your body is riddled with illness. And your mind is so heavy because you know I'm having this terrible karma in this life because of all the misdeeds that I've done in the past, right? So it's not just that his body is diseased, his mind is diseased, right? Guilt or shame, or, you know what I mean? All those kinds of things. So, you know, and I guess he's heard that there is this great Buddhist master who can, you know, remove that. So, yeah, these Zen men, they don't fool around. So he's coming to him, "Master, please absolve me of all my sins." Wiko looks at him. "Bring your sin right here and I will absolve it." That stopped him. And all of a sudden, Tseng Zan is looking now deeply into his mind for that sin that's in him, that he thinks is in him. So please, everybody, pretend you're Wiko, and close your eyes. And what is it in you? It may not be sin, you see, in that word, but what heavy-duty mind state? Guilt or shame, or anger, fear, resentment, you know, what is it within you? Still disturbs your mind and affects you. So close your eyes and just bring that to mind. Take your time. And you would love if somebody could absolve you of it, free you of it. You've been carrying this around. Guilt or shame or anger, resentment. That you feel is in you, in your mind. It's having negative impacts on your health, on your well-being, on your mind, maybe on your relationships. And all of a sudden you hear there's somebody, a teacher, who can remove that from you. Okay? So you go to the teacher and you say, I suffer because of this sin, this deed, this action that I've done, and it still weighs me down. Please absolve me. And the teacher says, I will. Please show me right now that whatever it is in you, the teacher says, show it to me right now. And so you turn and you look directly into your mind to find it, because if you find it, the teacher will remove it from you. And you look and you just, like, you're so, you want to be free. So you look in your mind for the shame, the guilt, the story, the narrative, the trauma, whatever it is. Not, you don't think, you're actually looking for it, because he's saying, show it to me. Right? Can you see? If this thing is so powerful, if this sin is such a powerful thing that's destroying your body, I want to see it. Show it to me so I can absolve you. So we don't know how long, hours, days. Tsang-san is looking in his mind to find that sin so he can take it out and show the teacher so he can be absolved. And after this deep introspection, this deep looking into his mind for the origin of that sin or defect or whatever it is, he finally comes back to the teacher and says, Master, when I look for this sin, I can't find it. And you know what the teacher said to him? I have absolved you. I have absolved you. So this is very much the Zen Chan tradition, right? Very interesting, right? You go to somebody and you tell them, oh, I'm burdened by this shame and guilt. And what do they say to you? You know, you go to a therapist, right? Many people, that's where they go. So you go to a therapist. I was a therapist for 30 years. So you go to a therapist and what do they say to you? Tell me about it, right? Tell me about it. So you tell them the whole story, right? Of your shame, of your guilt, of your, right? Right? You tell them the whole story. And then what do for the next 30 sessions? What?
Repeat.
Repeat? Yeah, I mean, what do you do for the next 10, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 sessions? What do you do? I mean, what do you do? What? You talk about it, you work through it, you right? That's our usual way. Does everybody know what I mean? Okay. But look at that, you see, this is different. Because the Buddhist understanding of mind is based on this teaching which the Buddha realized called emptiness. Has anybody ever heard this? This is often very confusing to people. Anybody ever heard this Buddhist teaching on emptiness or shunyata? What? You never heard it. Other newer people have heard it? Just nod your head, no, yes. Huh? Never. Okay. So this is one of the key teachings of Buddhism, Buddha taught, is this teaching of emptiness. Now, emptiness is not like this room is empty, you see? That's the way it sounds. What emptiness means in Buddhism is things are empty of selfhood. Things are empty of permanence. So this is very profound, right? Like we think this is a flower, right? Like this is a permanent solid thing, right? But if I took all the petals off and all the leaves off and scattered them on the ground, where'd the flower go? I mean, would you still come up here and go, well, look at that beautiful flower. Where'd the flower go? See, there never was a flower in any permanent solid way. All this is what? What is this? It's what? So it's a collection of myriad things, of seeds, of stems, of growth, of flowering, of wilting, of decay, sunshine, water, or I mean, there are myriad things that make this, in this moment, appear like a permanent thing. But we would say, but there's no permanent thing called a flower here. Flower is just a word, a designation that we call this. It is empty of kind of an essential permanent flower. Can you get what I'm saying? In other words, if I take this all apart and scatter it on the floor, would there be something called a flower? What happened to the flower? Because there never really was a self-existent permanent thing called a flower. It always just a collection of parts that came together in a temporary moment and then will dissolve. In the same way, I am called Fred. That is my name. And you might go, oh, there's Fred, right? And you might think, oh, there's Fred. Like I'm a, some kind of, like I'm a permanent thing, like there's a real thing called Fred. But if you did an autopsy on me, and you took me apart, and you, let's like the flower, and you scattered all the parts of Fred, would you find a little Fred? Would you? No. Parts, 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 parts. Well, Fred's in his mind. Just like with, what's his name? Sengsan. Right? He thought his sin was a permanent thing staining his mind. Right? He thought it was real and solid. And so he suffered. But in that moment, Wiko showed him, said, okay, I'll absolve you of your sin. Show it to me. He looked and he looked, he couldn't find it. Why couldn't he find it? Because it doesn't really exist in any permanent solid way. It is empty. Our minds are empty. Empty of what? Solidity. For example, close your eyes and bring up a thought and look right at it. Bring up a thought. You can bring up the thought of your name. Bring up the thought and look directly at it with your inner gaze. What do you see? when you look directly at that thought? What do you experience when you look directly at that thought? Are thoughts solid things? Permanent? When you look directly at a thought with this kind of curious investigatory mind, you know, what is a thought? Is it a solid thing? Many people think, I'm tortured by my thoughts. Right? Poor Saint-Saëns was tortured by his sin, something he had done. So when you look in your mind directly at a thought, what do you experience? Anybody want to just share online, just chat it in? What do you experience? Anybody new who's just here for the first time and then just looking? What do you see? I know you're not new, but you were saying you're new to the shunyata. So what do you see when you look directly at a thought? Well, hold on. Okay. Bring up a thought in your mind. What's the thought? All right, but you say, think, I'm a woman, okay? Just think that in your mind. Close your eyes, think, I'm a woman. And just look with your inner eye directly at that thought. What do you see? What happens to that thought as soon as you look at it? It disappears. Appears. But it's not, has any substance. You know, did it disappear because you're a magician, right? You have these magical powers and you didn't do anything, did it, to make it disappear? Oh, but you did do something. What did you do? You looked at it. You were mindful. If we're not mindful, thoughts can arise, right? That person, you know what I mean, right? You ever have those kind of thoughts? And before you know it, if we're not mindful, what happens? Yeah, it becomes your narrative, you're off and running, you have emotions, I mean, right? But what if that moment when a thought arose, you looked right at it and saw its empty nature, just arising, has no substance. What would that be like? Easier to live life, eh? Wouldn't go down all those paths we go down during the day. So this emptiness, even though like it's big, is actually very real. Now, the master knew that, you see, because he was awake. But he had a disciple who came to him who didn't know that, who thought what? This sin, this shame, this guilt, this deed was somehow alive in him and causing him all this disease. So the master, knowing the nature of mind, said a very simple thing. Yep. I will heal you, right? I will heal you, my son. But first you have to show me the sin so I can see it. And he knew what? That no matter how far or deep Saint-Saëns looked for it in his mind, he'd never find it. What would he discover? That it truly doesn't exist. And yet, if we are not mindful, if we're not aware, all these things do exist, don't they? And we're led about by them all day long. We're led about by them for years and decades. We carry this stuff with us. So I'm only trying to show that you know, emptiness, shunyata, big, but very important. Again, one of the discoveries of Shakyamuni in his great enlightenment was the empty nature of mind, that there's nothing solid in the mind, that mind is not like a physical, mind is not physical. Right? So if I said to you right now, look into your mind, can you touch your mind? Can you smell your, it's, if you pursue it and try to grab it, it's like a little kid who's gone out in the fog or something. Or maybe you once did, you know, you go in the fog, it looks like, wow, you know, looks real. Trying to grab it. You know, a kid chasing after the bubbles, you know, trying to grab it. It looks real. There's nothing there. So this is very profound, right? This kind of teaching. I'm just trying to share, you know, because many people, some in the hall, many online, you know, are not at the retreat. But these are the kind of things we're doing. Why are we doing it? To be free. So we can live with greater ease in life, greater simplicity, unburdened. Who wouldn't want to be unburdened? So I'll take a few minutes just answering any questions anybody has, and then we'll stop. If anybody has any questions online, please chat them in and Scott will relay them to me. Anybody in the hall have any question about anything I say? And for those of you who are new, I mean, if it doesn't make sense, if you think I'm totally wrong, that's fine. Okay. So, I mean, you know, this is kind of the deep end of the pool, as I often say. Any questions about this? Don't be shy. Anything not seem clear? Or how to apply this? Yes, sir. And so your name is?
My name is Jose Lazaro Quintero Santos. This is my second time I came here.
Okay, Jose, good.
Sometimes I think about how can I find the purpose of my life? Can you
How can I find the purpose of your life?
Yes.
That's a deep question, Jose. My sense, Jose, I don't know you, I've never met you, is the reason you're, how old are you? How old are you?
53.
So my sense is you've been alive for 53 years. And during those 53 years, you've probably had various purposes, right? Finish school, get through the day, get this, you know, you're right? I mean, you've probably had many purposes, you know, maybe to get a career or get a relation, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? You have many purposes in your life. And yet for some reason at 53, you're still going, but these don't really satisfy me, do they? You're looking for something more, aren't you? Is that right?
I am satisfied with my life.
Yeah.
But I think spiritually, I want to find something more.
All right. So So we might say you're satisfied with your worldly life. Things are basically okay, right? But there still seems to be something missing. Yeah, that's good. And there is something missing, right? Because like we talked about earlier, that whole, you know, you're like the Buddha. Do you know the story of the Buddha? A little like, you know. He was a prince, you know what I mean? Like, he probably even had a better life than you, right? He had servants, you know what I mean? He had a couple of different pleasure gardens, right? I mean, you don't have that, do you? No. So he, in a worldly sense, had a very, you know, he was satisfied. But contemplating sickness, old age, and death impermanent, knowing this whole thing's impermanent, this body is impermanent, relationships are impermanent, you know what I mean? There's nothing, right? And all that's going on in the world, he went, no, there's got to be something that transcends all this, right? Yeah. So he thought deeper meaning, just like Jose. So you're no different. The Buddha, that's what got him out of the palace, out of his comfortable life. All right. I'm not saying that you have to leave the palace, you know what I'm saying? but please understand that it doesn't have, you know, you don't have to go like, oh, I'm so suffering in life, I need, you know, sometimes life can be good. And yet you feel there's something missing. Right? There is something missing. What's missing is your connection to who and what you really are, to your true mind. Right? That's what's missing. Because we're wandering around in the world of the little self, missing our connection, our interconnection with all life, with everyone else, right? We feel separate, right? And so, you know, yeah. So it's good, right? And it's good to have a purpose, right? So a purpose in life could be, I really want to know myself. I really want to know who and what I really am in a deeper sense. You know, like, you know, you're Jose and you were born where, Jose?
I born in Cuba.
Yeah, born in Cuba, I lived there, then I came here, and then, you know what I mean? So you know all that, right? You know the story of Jose, but you don't know the story of the real Jose, right? Same way the Buddha didn't know. So in one sense, the spiritual journey is an inner search. You really want to know who you are, you know, and you really want to know why you still feel separate from people, right? Even though you may be around people all the time, there's like a separation, you know what I'm saying? Like that deep interpenetration, that oneness is missing, right? Okay. So that's the inner piece. So you want to kind of, but you've just heard the talk, it's all here, right? You don't have to go, you don't have to go back to Cuba, you don't have to go anywhere, you know what I mean? It's right here, inside you. You just need a methodology that helps you mine your own treasure, okay? Now, at the same time in the Buddhist path, you know, leading a purposeful life in life is also very important, right? So we would say, yeah, we all have our worldly responsibilities to fulfill, you know, career, relationships, saving for retirement, you know what I mean, all that, you know. But the most meaningful thing one can do with one's life is to help others, to be of service to others, to ease their suffering, you see. That's a very meaningful life. That's a good purpose, right? Because it feels good. You know, if we spend our lives always taking care of our own needs, focusing on our needs, right? It gives us a certain kind of happiness, but not a very deep happiness, right? Because the self is always demanding more. It's always needing more. You know, one hug is not enough. You know what I mean? You need a hug the next day. You know, what I mean? It's like, you see, it's never satisfied, right? But, you know, serving others, loving others, being compassionate and helping others, you know, that's always good, right?
Thank you.
Good, thank you. So I think we should stop there. Thank you, everyone.